Now, here is your host, John Hickman.
Good evening, everyone. The story you're about to hear is long overdue in the telling. It's the story of Gunsmoke, one of the most successful radio properties of recent times. The story, like a typical Gunsmoke script, is filled with drama, love, tragedy, fact, and emotion. It's also a story that, up until the present, has been largely ignored by serious broadcast historians. Cecil Smith, writing in his Los Angeles Times column in September 1975, said, "Gunsmoke was the dramatization of the American epic legend of the West, our own Iliad and Odyssey, created of the standard elements of the dime novel and the pulp Western as romanticized by Buntline, Hart, and Twain. It was ever the stuff of legend." Those legends, facts, and fantasies were brilliantly blended by writer John Meston in his portrayal of Dodge City, Kansas in the 1870s. Meston's cowtown was a microcosm of the American West, and in the center of it was Marshal Matt Dillon. We met and came to know him, his friends, and his enemies, and we learned of their life in a town referred to by historian Lucius Beebe as a suburb of hell. The picture that Meston painted of Kansas is remarkably accurate. There really was a front street in Dodge City. You actually could buy a drink at the Long Branch Saloon, the same saloon where Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson called the bluff of psychopathic killer Clay Allison, branding him a coward and driving him out of town. Chances are there was a doctor, similar to Meston's. Most likely the buffalo steaks served in the restaurants of the period did taste like shoe leather. And I can guarantee you that there were many kiddies in that Babylon of the plains. Tracing how the West has been dramatized by other writers would take 5 hours in itself. Suffice it to say that scores of writers have attempted to portray America moving west, from Ned Buntline of a century ago to Zane Grey of recent vintage. The West has been portrayed in feature pictures by such box office attractions as William S. Hart and Roy Rogers, and television has given us such thrillers as Hopalong Cassidy and Wild Bill Hickok. Radio, prior to a certain Saturday evening in 1952, offered Tom Mix, Red Rider, and the Lone Ranger, all in stories about good guys and bad guys, roping, rustling, fights, chases, and shootouts. And practically all of it was aimed at an adolescent audience. Looking back, it seems strange that it took from 1926, when network radio began, to 1952, a total of 26 years, for someone to offer an adult portrayal of the American West. The reason for radio's disinterest is best explained, I think, by the Peabody Award-winning writer, producer, and director, William N. Robeson.
It's the same old story. We bright young men who contributed the ideas to radio were urban-oriented. We were operating out of Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles. Those who operated out of Los Angeles, their subsidiary ethnic characters would be Japanese, like Mr. Watanabe, a house servant who featured in some situation comedy of years ago. Those of us who operated out of New York, our ethnic characters would be the stock black or the stock Irishman. And those who did their radio out of Chicago aped the manners of New York, aped the mores of New York. But they wouldn't think for a moment to look towards the West. They were very close to it, therefore they overlooked it.
One of radio's first attempts to treat the West on a more adult basis than Tom Mix or Red Rider was with a CBS program called Hawk Larrabee. The program debuted in the summer of 1947 and was directed by Bill Robeson.
Come along, folks, and listen to the tale of Hawk Larrabee on the western trail. Comatai-yi, yippee-yippee-yi, yippee-yi, comatai-yi, yippee-yippee-yi.
The Columbia Broadcasting System presents Hawk Larrabee, starring Barton Yarborough and his stories of the timeless West. Stories of men and women, famous and infamous, who loved and hated, lived and died in the colorful drama of the American West. Stories chronicled for you by Hawk Larrabee.
Larrabee was an assignment for me. I did not dream it up. I think probably it was Ernie Martin's idea. Ernie Martin was the program director at that time. He went on to become a very successful theatrical producer with such things as Where's Charlie and Mame and things like that. I don't know what his thinking was, but it was decided in the upper reaches of management to try a Western and see what would happen, see if it had any commercial bites. So they put it on Saturday afternoon. I doubt if it went 13 weeks. The original title was Hawk Durango. And then they discovered that Columbia Pictures down the street had released a movie called The Durango Kid, so they figured they better change that. It was a series of stories centered around the main character, whose name was Hawk Larrabee, a cowhand on a ranch in Texas, played by Barton Yarbrough, who had a wonderful and authentic Texas accent.
Well, I might have known Rita wasn't fooling, because next morning I got a message to meet Colonel Grayson in his office next to the ranch house. And there she was, standing behind his wheelchair, looking like a poker player just filled a bobtail flush.
Hawk, Rita's got a fool idea she wants to go on that cattle drive.
Hawk knows all about it, Dad.
Women is bad luck on a cattle drive, Colonel.
I've been trying to tell her that, Hawk.
Oh, superstition.
Well, how about Kate Mulrooney? Went up the Chisholm Trail with a Cross T outfit. The herd was lost.
Yeah, and the Comanches got Aggie Dawson's herd.
And the drive at Zero Parks went on. Well, they ain't never been heard from since.
Oh, coincidence, that's all it is.
Rita, this idea of yours is sheer tomfoolery.
But, Dad, since you can't go along, you ought to have somebody on that drive to represent you.
Larrabee represents me. He's a good ramrod, and I'm lucky to have him. Me crippled up with rheumatism this-a-way.
I want to go with the herd.
Colonel, I was hired as boss, is that right?
Sure, Hook.
Then either I have all to say about who's going to Abilene or a quit, right now.
Well, Rita, there's your answer. You ain't going with the herd.
Now Hawk thought his troubles were over. Colonel Grayson forbid her to go.
For authenticity, we employed a man named Kenneth Perkins, who had written a series of Western stories for the Saturday Evening Post. He was quite good and quite knowledgeable in his Western background. Or the Western background, which could be found in Argosy and True Stories and that sort of thing at the time. Now, whether that was authentic or not, I don't know. He would come up with such wonderful words that we'd never heard before, like take a passear, which meant to go out and look around, or make your play, and it was pretty heady stuff for us. At least in radio, we hadn't heard these kind of phrases. The dialogue was peppered with it, and then, of course, any time Barton Yarbrough turned on that wonderful accent of his, it had a true ring of authenticity. I think what it ended up being was a kind of a pictureless B-grade Western, the same kind of plot and character development that you'd find in a Roy Rogers movie. Maybe a cut above. Hawk never kissed the horse.
In the fall of 1947, Robeson began the prestigious dramatic series, Escape.
Well, Escape was an anthology show. In the truly brilliant thinking of show business at the time, since Suspense was such a great success, why not another show of the same kind? So Escape was pretty darn close to Suspense, and very often we used the same material. The assistant director, who was Norman McDonald for most of the Escape series when I was doing it, and who subsequently succeeded me as director on it for a while, the assistant director's function was to time the rehearsals, to time the show, and while on the air, advised the director how he was running, fast or slow, etc., and generally to take care of the mechanical end of the production. I used the finest actors in Hollywood. Jack Webb, who went on to become Sergeant Friday in Dragnet. Jeff Corey used to do a lot of things. Jeff Corey became and is now a well-known actor and director in Hollywood. Ben Wright, an Englishman born in Brooklyn who had a magnificent English accent, did many, many wonderful performances, such as in The Man Who Would Be King, I remember particularly. Sam Edwards, the wonderful Texas accent. and an authentic one. You could always get a Texas accent from these actors, but some of them weren't authentic. Jeff Chandler, the late Jeff Chandler, was one of our regulars. John Lund, a picture actor. John Daner, who was still very active in television. Then there was Parley Bear, who did much of the support work. Howard McNair was one of our absolutely invaluable support people. Georgia Ellis, of course, was one of our regulars, and Georgia became Kitty in Gunsmoke. And, of course, the man who came on and in deep tones said, "Want to get away from it all? Want to escape?" That man was Bill Conrad.
Tired of the everyday grind? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all? We offer you escape.
One of the mainstays, one of the strong right arms that I had was Bill Conrad.
This is Norman McDonald, producer-director of Gunsmoke.
Bill, for a long period, played the opening voice on Escape and would also play either bits or important parts. And Bill was, as were all the actors, perfectly content to have it work that way. Bill, for instance, played the great, huge, powerful Dutchman in Leiningen versus the Ants, which was one of the better Escape shows, I think, that I was ever connected with. Parley Bear would be an example of a man who, I remember a show that Parle played the lead on, Second Class Passenger, a funny kind of lost little man who gets into terrible difficulties in Algiers or Morocco or wherever it was, and Parley was just beautiful. On the other hand, Parley would play a little bit of a school teacher or a little bit of a country lawyer or doctor. The same with somebody like Howard McNair or a young ingenue, Georgia Ellis. If I remember correctly, she was the girlfriend of Will Rogers Jr. on a program called Rogers of the Gazette. So this little stock company was kept busy.
Story editor for Escape was John Dunkel, who in later years became a frequent contributor to Gunsmoke. Dunkel's departure from CBS opened the door for a promising young writer named John Meston. Again, Norman McDonald.
It was mid-year of 50 that John Dunkel left his position to freelance. He was indeed busy doing that. It was then that John Meston took over his job. John had been head of what we all called censorship, but a more high-powered bit of nomenclature would be continuity acceptance. But anyway, he took over Dunkel's spot and busied himself with working on scripts that were submitted and were going to various shows that were on the air at that time, like Suspense and Escape and others. Shortly after he joined the staff, Meston wrote his first script. As far as I was concerned, the first script of his that I worked on was Crossing Paris. That was on Escape and was, as I say, mid-year or a little after mid-year of 1950. John had never thought of himself, I don't think, as a budding writer, but it went well, and Crossing Paris received critical acclaim, and everybody was very taken with it. It was about 2 or 3 months later, on the same series, Escape, he did a western called Wild Jack Rhett.
You are standing in a moonlit street of a western cow town, alone and friendless. While moving slowly down on you, their horses crowding every exit, is a band of killers, each one of whom has been paid to shoot you dead.
It was something that John and I were becoming increasingly interested in, this approach to a Western, which was not like the others on the air. John, as a matter of fact, said there ought to be a way to do an adult Western, meaning that adults could enjoy it. It didn't, without any implication of psychological overtones or anything. When he said adult Western, he meant merely that it wasn't a kid Western. It was that simple. Wild Jack Rhett was the first of several shows that we experimented with, done in late 1950. We experimented with what was then called exaggerated sound patterns. They weren't exaggerated. It was merely that we avoided the old radio cliche of never have any dead air. We had lots of dead air, and it seemed to work. If If our lead walked across a room, we took time to let him walk across the room and didn't keep dialogue going. If somebody was leaving and crossing the street, we would hear the door close down the steps, across the sidewalk, and across the street. And it seemed to be very effective.
Three weeks later, Wild Jack Rhett rode into Red Mesa. He was 38 and at the peak of his reputation. He stood well over 6 feet, better than 200 pounds of plain sinew. Tawny blonde hair grew long in the frontier style, and his features were boldly aquiline. He was a picturesque man until one looked at his eyes, which were large and pale blue, and had the disconcerting trick of remaining too steadily on people. There was to be seen in them the suggestion of inhumanity. He sent word to the committee that he would meet them at the mayor's office that evening.
Well, it's 8 o'clock now. Where is he?
He's in town. That's bad enough.
Now, be a sport boy, Ellen. We took a fair vote on Rhett.
You'll learn the
hard
way.
Here he comes now. Here he comes. Here he comes. I'm sorry.
My name is Jack Rhett. I have your offer.
I'm Peter Wayne, mayor of Red Mesa. Do you accept it?
That depends on what you want. Tell me.
Well, Rhett, this is a difficult town. The Chisholm Trail lies just across the river, and we get most of our money from the riders passing through with Texas cattle. Now, we want them to have a decent time for their money, but we don't like a lot of gunplay and killing.
I've always been accustomed to complete authority, Mayor. I presume to know my job, and I won't have interference.
Well, that's agreed, Rhett. Oh, by the way, the last sheriff had a rule that riders leave their hardware at his office. He had trouble enforcing it.
A poor rule. Let them pack their guns.
It gives the wild ones a fair chance at you.
I never give a man a fair chance at me. Is that all, gentlemen?
We tried it again on a show called Pagosa, which was done on a series called Romance. And we used the same understated, blunt, somewhat laconic style. And again, we liked it. We felt it was a good way to do a Western. Bill Conrad was in that. He played a man called Jeff Spain. As a matter of fact, I've always referred to Pagosa as Jeff Spain, which it was not. You might say experiment number 2 or 3 on this new style.
It's mid-morning when Jeff Spain steps out of the Lark into Cherokee Street. Across the street and a few doors down, he sees a sign neatly lettered District Attorney, and underneath is the name of Duke Reese. Spain walks over quickly, throws open the door, and enters.
Well, Spain, I didn't expect you so soon.
I always try to be a little ahead of the other man.
Yes. Oh, yes, of course. Sit down.
I'll stand.
You don't like me, do you, Spain?
You were going to explain things to me, Reese.
All right, it doesn't matter. We'll make a profitable team anyway. Now, my offer still stands. $500 a month and 30% of the take.
Oh? And how would I earn it?
Well, your reputation will earn most of it for you. It's very simple, Spain. For the next 6 months, I shall want campaign contributions from the gambling halls and saloons hereabouts. I'm running for the state legislature, you know.
I didn't know.
Yes. And I'm sure everyone will contribute generously, knowing that if they don't, our sheriff will close them down for some good legal reason or other. I'll provide that. Well?
Why don't you send for some other gunfighter, Reese?
Why? When I can trust you.
What's your point, Reese?
Just that in 6 months you can have title to your land. And I think you want that.
And what guarantee do I have of it?
You don't need any. In 6 months, I'm leaving Pagosa. For good. I don't care what happens here after that.
And if I refuse?
In that case, I won't be able to afford to leave, will I? And if I do stay on here, Spain, Mitch Travis will file that title in my name.
I see.
And he'll file it in my name anyway, if you accept the job and you and I, shall we say, don't get along. You have till tomorrow morning to decide. Don't be a fool, Spain.
We all make mistakes, Reese.
A few minutes later, Spain rides out of town, taking the trail towards the chaparral where Cy Quill is waiting for him. There in the shade, they pass the afternoon in talk. And late that night, a pair of riders run in off the desert, put their horses in Teal Travis' stable, and walk back to the Kettle House, where in Spain's room, they make their final plans, and then go quietly to bed. Next morning, they come out of the hotel and head for the district attorney's office.
Reese, this is my partner, Cy Quill.
Oh? How do you do, Mr. Quill?
Howdy.
You still want to appoint me sheriff of Pagosa?
Then you've decided?
Yeah. Where's the badge?
Right here.
Good. Now get one out for Cy. I just made him my deputy.
What?
Give him a badge. I'm not new at this game, Reese, and I always appoint my own men.
Well, all right, if you insist.
Now go down to the sheriff's office and fire whoever's in there. Get him out by noon. I'll take over then.
Now, just a minute, Spain. I'm not used to being ordered around.
I can't fire your man. And tell him to turn loose any prisoners he's got in there. I don't like another man's leavings.
Meston and I wanted to do a series called Jeff Spain, which was an offshoot of the romance episode called Pagosa of mid-1951. And we approached CBS management with it, but they said no, they were developing a Western called Gunsmoke. Harry Ackerman had the title, and he had the writers, and he had the cast in mind. They made two, if I remember correctly, two audition discs with two well-known radio actors, but neither were successful, neither got on the air. Well, despite further urgings, we couldn't move the CBS executives to put the show on.
A popular Saturday evening program in April 1952 was Operation Underground, a forerunner of foreign intrigue. Its director was William N. Robeson.
Well, Operation Underground was another managerial brainstorm. They wanted to kill two birds with one stone, present an exciting adventure spy story, and make it very American and anti-communist. I think Harry Ackerman, who went on to television glory, dreamed this one up. What he dreamed up was a character named Ethan Allen Rogers, combining the identity of the conqueror of Ticonderoga and the inspirer of Kenneth Roberts' Northwest Passage, Rogers of Rogers Rangers. Our hero always went into the hotel room and found that it had been rifled. Or the climax was on the Orient Express, and as it went into the tunnel, he tosses the heavy through the window. It's that kind of a story, you know. Lamont Johnson played the starring role of Ethan Allen Rogers. Lamont Johnson, who has since then become a very fine motion picture director. It's a very interesting, very amusing story about this. Radio entertainment industry was undergoing widespread attacks for harboring communist sympathizers within the ranks of its actors, writers, producers, etc. And I was aware of this, and as a matter of fact, a target. And I laid on the anti-communist aspect pretty heavily, terms of Mr. Rogers' attitude towards his antagonists in Eastern Europe. And I was called in one day by an executive of CBS who said, come on, go easy on that anti-communist stuff. I said, well, what the hell is your position? He said, well, you know, we're against communists, but remember, communists buy products too.
CBS canceled Operation Underground in the third week of April, 1952.
Cancel is a harsh word. It was the victim of the usual network practice. The show is put on the air, and if it isn't picked up for sale after a reasonable amount of time, it's discontinued, and another type of entertainment is put in there in its place. And in this case, Gunsmoke was the other kind of entertainment, and I can't think of a better replacement.
We had a week's notice to put a show together and get it on the air, and in that week we had to find a writer, we had to find a star, we had to have a theme, a Gunsmoke theme composed, so it was a busy week. We got Walter Brown Newman to come in, one of the better writers in town. We gave him an acetate disc of Pagosa, and I believe of Wild Jack Rhett, and said, this is the style, this is the color, this is the feel. We laid out no other guidelines except told him how we felt Matt Dillon should be written and the kind of character he was, and sent Walter away. That was on a Monday.
With the Gunsmoke script in preparation, a CBS program executive called composer-conductor Rex Corey in for a meeting.
He said, have you ever done a Western? So I said, no. I said, I don't think that. I'm not a Western writer in that sense of the word, but I said, I'm game to tackle anything. What do you have in mind? Well, he says, we've got a new show we want to put on, and a chap by the name of Norman McDonald is going to direct it, and Norm knows exactly what he wants, and if you think you would like to do it, why don't you go downstairs and talk to Norm? I proceeded to go down to his office. We sat down and talked. I immediately was charmed by Norm. He's a man with a magnetic personality. He knew what he wanted. He said, Rex, this is a different type of Western than I think that you have probably ever seen. We call this an adult Western. And he said, our approach will be purely, it isn't the shoot-em-up chase type of Western that the public is used to. These will be adult stories located in the West, but there will be emotional stories, there will be stories of suspense and action and various other aspects. And he said, we would like to have a seasoned musical director who can tackle a job with that understanding and that perspective. Would you be interested in doing it? And I said, well, from what you've told me already, I would certainly not want to turn it down. So he said, well, fine. Now, about the theme, he said, we want something that has a big, wide-open sound to it, something that suggests the open spaces. He said, the main character, Matt Dillon, is a very complex character, one that you'll want to understand. And we delved into the various aspects of it. I think almost immediately we formed a cohesion of ideas that was to carry us through in what has become a very, very long and extensive venture. I always wrote what I call the interior music first. The reason I did this was by the time that I had written the so-called interior music, I had developed within myself the feel and the sound that I ultimately would want to establish for the whole series. So I always left the theme till the end, and the theme is written under rather frantic circumstances because I had gone to bed the night before, leaving that to be done with the feeling that I knew pretty well what I wanted and figuring that I could do it rather quickly in the morning if I got up early enough. I didn't get up early enough, and the music always had to be into what we call the copyist. Now, the uninitiated probably doesn't know that all music that is composed for orchestra is composed on master score sheets. In other words, we work by the page, putting down all the instrumental parts, whether they be percussion or strings or woodwinds or brass or whatever. They all go on what we call a master score. Now, these parts, the individual parts that the instrumentalist plays, all have to be hand-copied off the original master score. So the music or the score had to be into the copyists, the people that did this work, in plenty of time so that they could get their job done in time to have them on the music stands by recording time or by broadcast time. So that I had to have the music in this particular morning into the CBS copyist by something like 9:30 or 10 o'clock. Here at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm in the middle of shaving, and I suddenly realize that I haven't written the theme. So I grabbed a magazine, a piece of manuscript, and a pencil, and sat down in the most convenient spot, and that is where the Gunsmoke theme was actually composed. It was composed in a matter of about 10 minutes and rushed to the copyist along with the rest of the music.
There remained the problem, of course, the enormous problem of finding a star. The CBS executives, of course, were hoping for a big name. I do remember that there was a young actor from Pasadena who had some name at that time, Robert Stack. If I remember correctly, Ray Burr auditioned.
I think when they started casting for it, somebody said, good Christ, let's don't get Bill Conrad. We're up to you know where with Bill Conrad. So they did not get Bill Conrad. They auditioned everybody in town. And as a last resort, they called me and said, okay, we give up. Come on in. And I went in and read about two lines, and they said, okay, thank you. And I walked out, and the next day they called me and said, you have the job.
I think Meston and I were more enthusiastic about Conrad than the executives, because Bill was considered a heavy at that time. He'd just finished doing The Killers in feature pictures, and everybody considered him a heavy. And, of course, he was a marvelous heavy. So I think the CBS executives were a little concerned that William Conrad, a heavy extraordinaire, would be playing our lead, Matt Dillon. The other characters were not set and no contracts were drawn because nobody had yet decided who would be playing with Bill. It just developed that Howard McNair played the Doctor, who became a running character. Parley Bear played Chester, who became a running character. Georgia Ellis was in one of the first shows, but Kitty wasn't actually invented until, perhaps 8 or 10 shows into the series. I think Georgia played another saloon girl, but was not Kitty.
The very first broadcast occurred Saturday evening, April the 26th, 1952, 24 years ago tomorrow. The script revolved around a 12-year-old boy who was to become a legend in the West.
Can you direct me to the marshal's office?
Yes, ma'am, right here. I'm Marshal Dillon.
Well, I left Cottonwood as soon as I got your telegram. I'm Miss Bonnie. Where's my boy?
Oh, we have him, ma'am, safe and sound. Here, let me help you down.
Thanks.
Hitch that horse, Chester. Right this way, ma'am.
Oh, I'm so sorry he put you in all that trouble, Marshal. The truth of the matter is he's a wild one and no mistake. Takes after his father, one scrape after another.
He was no trouble at all. I enjoy children. I like to have them around. Bub, your ma's here. Son? Chester, where's the boy? Did you let him slip past you?
No, sir, Mr. Dillon. He never got past me. Look, the back door's open.
He seen me and he hightailed it, the devil.
We'll round him up for you, ma'am. Don't worry.
Oh, I don't know why I bother hauling him back. If he's run away once, he's run away 1,000 times. This time he ran because I wouldn't buy him a gun. He wanted a real one. Boy's just gun crazy, I swear. I got him a nice Barlow knife instead.
Barlow
knife? I reckon it didn't signify, and off he runs.
Barlow knife? That kid. Chester, find that kid.
Marshal, has he done something bad with it? I told him to use it careful. He promised he'd use it careful.
Never mind, Chester. He's got Clay's strawberry roan. We'd never catch up to him.
Oh, I try to bring him up right. I tell him to be good, but he don't listen. He just don't listen.
Now, calm yourself, ma'am. Just calm yourself.
Here's his little bundle, Mr. Dillon.
What? Yeah, give it to me. It's pretty heavy. Here, you're better at knots than I am. Open it, will you?
From the moment he was born, he's been nothing but tribulation to me.
Now, please, ma'am. What's he got in it, Chester?
A shirt, stockings, a piece of sausage, and this.
44 double action.
Yes, sir, Mr. Dillon. That's Clay's gun. Sonny didn't manage to keep it long, did he?
Well, if he wants a gun that bad, he's bound to get hold of another one somewhere, somehow. Chester, call Mr. Hightower over.
Hey! Hey, Mr. Hightower!
Oh,
supper. Mr. Dillon wants you.
Marshal, could I have please a drink of water?
What? Oh, Ziegler, I forgot all about you. Chester, where are the keys?
Yeah, right there on the desk. Oh.
There we are. It'll be safe for you to go home now.
I can go back by the farm.
Yeah, that's right. I'll send for you for the trial.
Oh, danke schön. Danke schön.
Watch where you're going, you dumb...
Bitte, excuse me. Bitte.
Yes, Marshal.
Mr. Hightower, it appears that we can do business after all. Get some paper and a pencil. I want some notices printed.
Fire away.
Wanted for murder.
Wanted for murder.
What's the boy's name?
Bonnie. William Bonney.
William Bonney.
William Bonney.
Age 12. Height about 5 feet.
5 feet.
Hair light, eyes blue. Mm-hmm. I don't suppose he's known by any other name.
No. Everybody just called him Billy. Or the kid.
Also known as Billy. The kid.
We'll return to the biography of Gunsmoke in just one moment.